Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering Kingston City Council's decision to move forward with a controversial waterfront high-rise.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
Yet another controversial development came before council at their meeting on Tuesday night. This time, a high-rise at Kingston's waterfront containing luxury apartment units. 5 Lower Union Street, currently a vacant wharf next to the Great Lakes Museum and Historic Dry Dock, is the site proposed by developer Homestead Land Holdings. The 19-story mixed-use building laid out in the proposal would provide 118 units, with 225 bedrooms total. The journey to council approval has been long for this proposal, with discussions starting in 2019. Councillor Connie Glenn started the discussion, cautioning council against moving forward with the development. Her first key concern was the community response.
It was a very contentious build, and I think that one of the fundamental issues that was brought forward is the community felt a lack of consultation. And I know that there are going to be a lot of counters to that. However, unfortunately, this development took a long time to make its way through the system. So initial consultations took place before this council even came into being. It was under the previous council, and a lot of it took place virtually. So there were a number of individuals, I think, quite caught off guard by this and wanted the opportunity to speak against it. But at the end of the day, when we're building a community, it's important that the community feels we're actually building with them. And this just didn't hit the mark in that way. They felt that it was being built despite them, despite their legitimate concerns, and despite the fact that they felt they had a different vision for our city. And ignoring the concerns and the vision of constituents who actually currently live and reside in this place, I think is fundamentally going to be problematic for us as we move forward. I know that we say we're listening, but sometimes I'm really concerned that we're not hearing them.
In addition to the consultation piece, she also expressed concern regarding what this could mean for the future of Kingston's waterfront.
I also think that we are challenged here with what we are doing along our waterfront. We're seeing multiple proposals for various things to go along the waterfront, and we've heard criticism from the community about putting more tall buildings right on the water, like other cities have done, only to regret them much later on, because that space is no longer there for the community.
Glenn concluded, noting a criticism that has come up with many recent residential developments.
I asked some questions about the affordability of this, and the reality is that these are not going to be affordable units. They're going to be very expensive units on the water. So yes, we're in a housing crisis, but the housing crisis is one of affordability. So until we're building more affordable units, like the ones that we're looking at for Verona, I don't think that we're making the mark, and I don't think that this makes the mark.
However, Councillor Wendy Stephen represented a different perspective.
The property taxes that come from this new build will feed into our operating budget. And our operating budget is what we use to do things like supportive housing. And we just approved supportive housing, and we know it's going to be expensive, and we need that money over time. So I think the argument that this isn't affordable housing, I mean, yeah, it's not, that's true. But through those property taxes, that generation will allow us to create more. We also need housing of all kinds. We've been through this a million times. We are in a housing crisis. We are still short. This will help.
In addition to this point, she mentioned some of the positive features the development could bring to the waterfront.
It's not just private residential. It is that. But it's also got continuation of the waterfront trail, which wouldn't be possible unless this land was developed. And it's also adding in green space for the community at the waterfront. Like, this is a win.
Ultimately, the amendments required for the development to move forward passed with a vote of 10-3.
I think that once it is built, I think people are actually going to like it.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for YGK News, Owen Fullerton, about the creation of a new research network at Queen's University.
Thank you, Jesse. The Queen's University Center for International and Defense Policy announced two grants to support the launch of the Global Feminist Resilience Network last week, totaling $30,000 to help fund the network that will connect existing research programs in a data preservation effort. Dr. Stefani von Latke, Queen's Faculty of Arts and Science researcher and co-lead of the network, says the main priority of the network is to push back against the growing backlash against equity, diversity, and inclusion efforts and expertise, especially in the United States. The network connects Queen's and other institutions in Canada and throughout the world that have launched initiatives related to women, peace, and promoting gender security. Dr. von Latke says the role of the network will be to preserve data that in recent years has found itself in danger of erasure, with some expertise and data sources disappearing already. The aim of the work done by the network, she says, is to allow policymakers and the academic community to continue to do their work through a gender lens, and for the next generation of experts to be aided in their work in what has become a more hostile research environment. It's a partial response to a growing wave of dismissiveness towards scientific evidence and pushing policy in spite of that evidence. So far, Dr. von Latke says some actions taken in the United States have been devastating in the short term, and that it's important now to try to take a long-term view of preserving evidence for a time when the political climate is more welcoming for this type of research. The network will bring together a variety of experts at universities worldwide, but Queen's will act as the de facto hub and home base of the research network. Dr. von Latke says the CIDP already has an engaged community of experts on gender and security and provides a foundation to further build upon, with different roles becoming more specified as it gains legs. While the network's genesis has largely been in response to the suppression of certain areas of scientific research in the United States, it doesn't mean that there aren't concerns and such growing trends in Canada and other democracies. Dr. von Latke says some experts fear that if the type of political rhetoric seen in the United States is able to thrive, the country's massive influence could force other countries to turn a blind eye or even turn back progress made on gender equality issues. The network's official launch, or first meeting with all partners, will take place in Brussels, Belgium, on the week of October 13th. Thank you to Owen Fullerton for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with a story from the LGA reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about Gananoque Town Council's request for clarification on Mayor John Beddoes' budget directive.
Thank you, Dinah. Gananoque Council has unanimously backed a motion from Councillor David Osman requesting that Mayor John Beddoes provide more detail on his use of Ontario's strong mayor powers to guide the town's 2026-2027 budgets. The motion, seconded by Councillor Anne-Marie Coyner, asks Beddoes to present supplemental information on Mayoral Directive 2025-002 at the September 16th Council meeting. Council will then be able to comment on and vote individually on the 27 items in the directive. Osman noted that the strong mayor powers were still new and that Council wanted to understand how they worked. He called the budget a $25-plus million document that requires input from staff, management, and Council. Beddoes welcomed the feedback. The mayor's directive, issued under Ontario's Strong Mayors Building Homes Act, sets out priorities including parking enforcement changes, tax and fee adjustments, and potential marina expansions. In the area of parking enforcement, the mayor suggests measures such as clamping Quebec-plated vehicles to ensure compliance. Beddoes has said that the measure stems from an inequity, as Ontario drivers who do not pay parking tickets cannot renew plates or driver's licenses, whereas Quebec residents face no consequences because the province lacks a reciprocal enforcement agreement. The draft budget will undergo council review and public consultation this fall before any decisions are made.
Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the relocation of a youth hub in Greater Napanee.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. The Greater Napanee Youth Services Coalition will be moving to the Napanee train station. With another program currently in the space, moving will begin September 2nd. The coalition will then begin to use the west side of the building as a youth services hub for ages 12 to 29. The program that currently occupies the space is run by the Morningstar Mission, a full-time mission providing food, fellowship, prayer, and other essential services. Director of Parks, Recreation, and Culture with the Town of Greater Napanee, Chris Brown, spoke about the cooperation that helped plans come together.
Exciting stuff. We're happy that everyone was able to come together and make it work. And I'm thankful for everyone that assisted me with meeting me on site, going over everything, and just being very receptive to moving from the Morningstar, and also for the Youth Services Coalition. I do remember a quote that day that was, "We got to start somewhere." And I think this is going to be a really good opportunity.
Brown detailed some of the timeline for how the moves have come together.
Back in May, Council received a deputation from the Greater Napanee Youth Services Coalition seeking the town's support for a one-year pilot project to establish a youth wellness hub at 12 Market Square. At the second meeting in May, staff brought back a report just to discuss the building at 12 Market Square and look for council direction. Council was still interested in staff continuing those discussions with the Greater Napanee Youth Services, just regarding potential partnership opportunities and exploring alternative locations for the youth wellness hub. And so council directed staff to provide an update on those discussions at July 22nd meeting, we didn't have enough time. So since then, staff have met with the Greater Napanee Youth Services Coalition at the Napanee train station, specifically on the west side of that building.
Brown spoke about the space in the west side of the train station.
The west side of the train station building is currently occupied by the Morningstar Mission's furniture program. So in order to make the youth services hub work at the train station, staff then reached out to Morningstar Mission and their volunteers to find a suitable location to move that furniture program. The furniture in there from the program currently leasing that space was a little bit in the way, but we were able to do a little bit of a tour to look at the space. They did inform us that they would be interested in going into that space if it was available.
Brown spoke about moving the Morningstar Mission to the Conservation Park Garage.
We figured that the best place to start would be the Conservation Park Garage. So we met the Morningstar Mission staff and volunteers at that site, and we toured. The garage is split into a couple different sides. One side's a little bit smaller, easier to heat, armed, locked cameras, which they were very happy to hear, a little bit closer to the mission itself. And so they said they could make it work. We will be looking to move the furniture that's in the train station west side right now down to the Conservation Park Garage on September 2nd, starting around 9 a.m. And then once that happens, we'll be giving the train station west side a deep clean and then inviting the Youth Services Coalition to come look at the space again as a vacant space and then start to move their stuff in.
Brown detailed the next steps for staff and council.
One thing that we'll want to do is we'll want to make sure that we have facility use agreements drafted and brought back to council for final approval. So the Morningstar Mission would move their furniture program to the Conservation Park Garage, and then the Youth Services Coalition will then start to move programming into the train station west side. We'll get a nice sign. The east side of the train station will say via rail. The west side would have a new sign for this Youth Services Wellness Hub Youth Services Coalition.
Councillor Angela Hicks thanked community partners for their cooperation.
I would like to say thank you to the community partners, the Youth Wellness Hub and Morningstar, for being flexible. And I think I can say for once, everybody's happy.
Mayor Terry Richardson showed his support for the move.
It's kind of nice when a plan comes together and we've got it, you know, we've made two groups happy, so that's good.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about a fundraising partnership between the Northumberland United Way and local auto dealerships.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. A two-month fundraiser from the United Way Northumberland will see donations made by area dealerships on the purchase of a vehicle. The Cars for Community campaign is hoping to raise funds to support housing, food access, and mental health services in Northumberland County. United Way Executive Director Alicia Van Dyne says they have an ambitious fundraising goal.
Cars for Community is a fundraiser that our car dealership started about 4 or 5 years ago, and they donate $10 from the sale of every car between September and November. And so it started out with just one dealership. We had Cobourg Honda. Nick over there was the one who came up with this idea. He had seen it in another market. And we started approaching other dealerships to join in. And, you know, I'm really proud to say we've got 5 on board this year, which is really exciting. So we've got, of course, Cobourg Honda. We've got Cobourg Mazda. We have Cobourg Kia, which is new this year, and Campbellford Chrysler is returning to this fundraiser. So also want to send our thanks out to the True North Auto Brokers, brand new last year. So it's been a growing little fundraiser for us. The community is always so generous that people that are looking for a new vehicle, often they'll make a donation and the dealership will provide that to us as well.
So then, take us back. You started out with one dealership. They approached you. How did you see this program expand into the dealerships? How did you approach the dealerships and say, this is a good initiative? And then how have you seen the amount of vehicles being sold and seeing the pot of money rise?
You know, I think all the dealerships are just looking for a way to support charity, and it just seems to make sense for them. It's almost like their workplace campaign. And so when you think of our manufacturing partners like Cameco and CPK, who do the traditional payroll deduction, this was a way for the dealerships to do a workplace campaign without having to do the payroll deduction.
So have you seen it kind of like maybe a bit of a rivalry, maybe in terms of inside the dealerships and among the dealerships themselves, to see who can raise the most amount of money?
You know, I think that just stems from the culture of car sales, because they're all a competitive environment. And for us, over these 2 months, there's a little bit of community competition too. So that's always lovely to see.
So let's talk about what the money does, this program. Where's the money going, and how do you see that benefiting the community?
And so this money directly goes into the investments that we make into the community in our 3 pillar areas: kids can be all they can be, building strong communities, and lifting people out of poverty to possibility. And so the money that we raise through Cars for Community is going to directly support those investments that we're making in the community, in our other not-for-profit partners. And so it's kind of a multiplier, if you will. People make a donation there, and we're able to suss out the best charities to select and make sure that the money is going to great causes. And this year, just a little addition for our special anniversary this year, we had some of the car part and auto sector partners want to support the dealerships in this. And so they were able to provide a donation to us. And so this year we have East End Auto Repair. We have NoCo Auto Works and the Brighton Automotive and Industrial Supply. And of course, one of the newest businesses in town, the Tinney Auto Spa. And so they've made a donation in support of Cars for Community. And it's really nice to see the car sector working together. I think in the world that we live in today, they're definitely the folks who are feeling the biggest pinch, and yet they're still community-minded, and it's very inspiring.
Now, what's the fundraising goal this year?
So this year, our goal is to make $10,000. Last year, we did just over 6, I believe. So it's a little bit of an aggressive jump this year, but we're going to see what we can do.
So outside the dealerships that you're working with, what changes have you seen, or are you trying to
get you to that $10,000 mark?
So I think what you're going to see this year on our social media, we have some reels that we're going to do and interview some of the sales folks just to help encourage people to let them know. Because as you know, thanks to small town radio, we're able to reach out to so many listeners, but social media is definitely something that you'll be seeing over the next couple of months on our pages. So I would encourage listeners to go and see and check out the businesses that we're featuring.
Now, if I don't purchase a new car, how do I still participate in the program?
You can actually make a donation by calling the United Way office, 905-372-6955, and just say, I'd like to make a donation in support of Cars for Community, and we'll add that to the total.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, September 11th, even warmer still, a daytime high of 23 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud. However, it is going to drop down to 8 degrees overnight, so we are starting to get those chillier fall evenings. Friday, September 12th, daytime high of 19 degrees with sunny conditions. Saturday, September 13th, daytime high of 20 with an overnight low of 13. Sunday, September 14th, 75% chance of precipitation in the area with a daytime high of 21 degrees and showers all throughout the day. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, September 15th, daytime high of 22 degrees with a 70% chance of rain in the forecast. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Let's begin with road closures. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess to Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne, closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Cranbrook Street, Lakeview to Days, closed on school days from 8:40 a.m. to 9:20 a.m. and 3:20 p.m. to 3:50 p.m. for School Street at Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic School. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Innovation Drive, John Marks to Innovation South, closed September 10th at 7 a.m. to September 18th at 6 p.m. for the installation of storm and sanitary sewers. Kings Court Avenue, concession to First, is closed until October 10th for a gas main installation. Lincoln Drive at Bay Ridge, closed until September 19th for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure. Montreal Street at Rideau and Railway is closed September 11th at 11 p.m. to September 12th at 6 a.m. for paving operations. Princess Street at Taylor Kidd and John Counter, closed September 10th at 11 p.m. to September 11th at 6 a.m. for paving operations. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen, closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Victoria Street, Union 2 Johnson, is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Woodburn Road, Hitchcock to Whitechurch, is closed for a contractor to complete culvert relining. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Cataraqui Woods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners, expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford. Expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle. Expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead structure. John Marks Avenue and Innovation Drive. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to start work on John Marks Avenue, Innovation Drive, and Discovery Avenue. Work includes curb, sidewalk, asphalt milling, and repaving. Lancaster Drive, Limestone to Jasper. Expect delays while a contractor completes construction of a new sidewalk and road improvements. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users and accommodate increased traffic from the Wabin Crossing. Trudell Road, development to Danbury. Expect delays while a contractor completes road and sidewalk improvements. And Victoria Street and Earl Street. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit cfrc.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via cfrc.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.